Bluegrass Jam Along is proud to be sponsored by Collings Guitars and Mandolins, each and every one built from the sound up in Austin, Texas. This episode is also brought to you by Peghead Nation, the home of roots music instruction. If you want to improve your playing, join me and thousands of other pickers getting better every day at pegheadnation.com. Hi, this is Matt, and you're listening to Bluegrass Jam Along, the podcast for anyone and everyone who loves bluegrass. Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of Bluegrass Jam Along. This is an interview with Stephen Mogin. Stephen is the guitar player in the Sunbush Band. He owns and runs Dark Shadow Recording Studio and record label, and I met him at IBMA in September, where he was running a band coaching session, which I found fascinating. So I went up and said, look, do you fancy having a chat about this for the podcast? And he said, yeah, definitely. And so it then took a while to get around to organising it, just because I've had so many other bits to organise the podcast. But I'm delighted that we did get a chance to chat last week. And I think there's so much in this one, whether you're a musician, a band member, even if you are just a fan of bluegrass and you want to deepen your kind of understanding and appreciation in music, I think there's a lot in here for you as well. So it was a really cool conversation. I think there's so much great stuff in here to learn about how bands function. Then we touch on how Stephen thinks bands should be rehearsing, how to listen to music with a sort of critical ear, so many things. I really enjoyed this, and I hope you do too. Here comes my conversation with Stephen Mogin. My guest on Bluegrass Jam Along this week is somebody who wears very many hats, and I suspect I could talk to him about any one of them and have a fascinating conversation, but we're here to talk about one in particular, and we'll probably cover a few of the others as we go. My guest is Stephen Mogin. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me. Nice to be here.
I feel like we could talk about songwriting, we could talk about running a studio, we could talk about running a label, we could talk about your work with the Sunbush Band, we could talk about so many things, but the reason that sort of kicked all this off, I came to IBMA for the first time in September, and I think maybe the first session that I came to was a band coaching session that you did, and I found it a fascinating thing to watch. And not only is it incredibly interesting, I suspect there will be things that will come out of us chatting about it that would be incredibly helpful to many of the musicians who listen to the podcast. And so I'd just love to chat about it. There's so much of playing in a band that people take for granted and just think you learn your instruments, you get together, you stand on stage, and it all comes together. And there's so much more to it than that. How did you get into band coaching in the first place?
Well, it's sort of a natural progression of my training, which is as a middle school. Well, my degree's in vocal music education. I went to college to be a choir director, and I started teaching at a middle school and high school in Western Massachusetts, and taught music theory, taught high school choir, middle school choir, ran the musicals. And a large part of your job as a choir instructor or band instructor is to take the global sound of what you're listening to and dial in on what's working, what's not working, and tactics to fix that, to help things improve. And, being mindful of the current skill set of the players. The assembly process of how it all works and how a band is supposed to work together. I guess it's just something that developed for me over the years. I played in bluegrass bands for a long time, and I've really, really studied the workings of the great bands in bluegrass, on down the line, whether it was Flat and Scruggs or the Stanley Brothers or Lonesome River Band or Allison Krauss and Union Station, on and on. I've really spent a lot of time thinking about what makes their sound, and how do the instruments work together to make that happen. And one of the really great ear training techniques that is I encourage all of your listeners to try this. It sounds kind of basic and whatever, but it really helps build this skill set. Take any single bluegrass tune that you love and a blank piece of paper and a pencil, and listen to it with headphones or at least really good speakers alone in a quiet space, totally focused on nothing but the music. You shouldn't be thinking about folding your laundry, rather the song. And so the first time you listen down on the left side of the page, write the order of things happening. Okay, kickoff, banjo, verse one, chorus one, mandolin solo, whatever it happens to be, and chart that on the left side of the page. And that's your only job the first listen. The second listen, follow one instrument all the way through the tune and just write what they're doing. Rhythm guitar, playing very aggressively in this section or playing more sparse in this section, lots of runs in this section, whatever you observe. There are no wrong answers here. Go all the way through with the guitar, then go back through with the banjo. And all right, when are they back playing backup? When are they chopping? When exactly are those backup licks happening? All that kind of stuff. And go back through with the mandolin, go back through with the fiddle, go back through with each of the vocal parts, the lead vocal. Are they deviating from their stated melody as the song progresses? If so, how and maybe why? Is there a lyrical decision they made to sing higher on this one part? Or is it just because they felt good? You know, kind of make those sort of assessments as you go. And you will have listened to the song 8-9 times, but you will have a better understanding of how that song was put together by that band. And then the next step is, on another day, take another song and do the same thing. And what you will begin to build are some general best practices for how bands work together. Okay, fiddle and mandolin, probably not chopping at the same time. That's something you wouldn't know unless you noticed it. You know, what is the role of a dobro in a band? Okay, if it has a full five-piece plus a dobro, or if it's just like the infamous String Dusters with no mandolin. There's a dobro, but no mandolin. How do they put things together? How do they fill the spot vacated by the mandolin? Those kind of things. I spent a lot of time thinking about all of that over the years and doing some heavy listening. And I come from a time where we would go to a festival in the summer, and at the end of the weekend, my folks and I would go to all the bands and we'd decide which band we were going to buy one cassette from. And we'd go get the cassette and we'd bring it home and I would ingest it. It's all I would listen to front to back. So I knew every note, every kickoff, every fill lick. And it's maybe a little different style than how people learn these days, because things are so much one tune here, one tune there, one tune. The collection is maybe a little bit lost. And I don't know, you know, I'm not saying it's better or worse. It's just, I have internalized what the Country Gentlemen sound like. I've internalized what the Bluegrass Cardinals sound like. I've internalized what the Lonesome River Band from a certain era sounds like. And a lot of young musicians are doing this too. But it's easier to do when there's just one collection and that's all you can listen to for the next 3 weeks. You hear stuff a little differently in that regard, rather than the Spotify way of listening to a song and then another song and then another song. So I don't know. That's a really great listening exercise, and I very much encourage folks to do it. That's kind of the core of what I'm doing as I'm listening to a band for the first time. But as I'm listening, I am switching between all those instruments as it goes down, and I'm listening to it all kind of at once. I'm not really hearing it all at once, but I'm switching so quickly that I'm able to identify what's working and what isn't. And then, you know, just figuring out a way, it's problem solving, just figuring out a way that we can make it better, make those players more successful, make the band sound better than the sound of the individual players.
And I think that's fascinating because, certainly from personal experience, like I used to listen to music a lot, and then life gets busy, or just the way you listen to music changes. And then you realize that maybe you're hearing music a lot of the time, but not really. Like, and I try and make time now every day to sit and listen to music with headphones on while I'm doing nothing else. And, you know, and it is amazing how much more you pick up on when you're just doing that. And that, I love the idea of following individual voices through piece and just seeing, because it's simple things like when the mandolin takes a break, who takes over chopping? Is it the fiddle? Is it does the banjo do something percussive? Is the dobro doing a sort of chop? And they're things that pass you by, but they're such strong skills to have if you play those instruments, to know, or even just as a band, who's going to fill this space, who's going to take this thing. So I love that. I will definitely be doing that myself, get a piece of paper out and going through.
It's very interesting. And kind of, if you're going to go down the rabbit hole of doing this, try to make a catalog of what era of bluegrass are we listening to? Because 80s bluegrass is very different than 90s bluegrass, is very different than what's coming out now. And I love them all. I love them all for various reasons. But if, you know, as a studio player, as a producer, I want to know, you know, we get a new tune in and, you know, maybe we're working on Rick Ferris's next record and there's a tune that needs that, you know, whatever, pick a band. It needs a vibe of that. And to have players in the room that understand when I say, hey, we want this to sound like late Country Gentlemen. We want the members to understand what to do in that regard. We want the banjo player to know if they're supposed to chop or not supposed to chop. You know, and that's a very different thing depending which era you're listening to. But, you know, if you're going to go down the rabbit hole, I would encourage you, once you start listening and getting used to the process, maybe start cataloging what that looks like and maybe focus on one band at a time for 4 or 5 songs. Even from one album, and then move across or whatever makes you happy. But I think there's so much to be learned from everything. Let me back up. Everything we play and do now is based on what was already done. There's only 12 notes, right? There's nothing new. There's new ways to put it together, maybe, but even simple things like musicians who learn solos from players that play different instruments, right? If you were, there was a fascinating post, I guess it was back in COVID times, Bebe Bowness put this amazing version of herself playing a Tony Rice solo on banjo, and it's phenomenal and it sounds totally outside because it's you twist your ear because it's coming out of it's the wrong sound. But there's a lot to be learned from that. There's great players, great licks, great musical ideas that can be, you know, parsed and used in other places. I had a great teacher tell me once, if you steal from one person, it's plagiarism. If you steal from everyone, it's research.
Yeah, I love that. It's true. You can, I think sometimes you can get stuck in habits playing a certain instrument, of playing that instrument rather than playing music. You play the patterns and the shapes and the phrases that are associated with that. And even just learning some fiddle breaks as a guitarist, you have to find ways around things because double stops and slurs and slides and all sorts of things you can't replicate, but you can find a way of incorporating it.
Yeah. And I think, there's many levels of this. There's folks that just want to play and just have fun doing it and sort of that's it. They learn enough to kind of play Blue Ridge Cabin home and function in a jam session and have a good time with their friends. And that's a 2 thumbs up for me. That's winning. Music is supposed to be fun. For folks that want to get deeper and want to get better, you really do have to dig in and learn more about where it all comes from and all that. And one of the hardest things to do to get from that beginner to intermediate stage or even the professional stage is get outside yourself. When we play, you spend so much time alone learning what to do on this chord, how to sing this note, and it's all internal. And so the first inclination, your beginners step into a jam session, and as they're singing as if no one else is playing with them. And they're playing solos as if no one else is playing with them. And they're playing rhythm guitar, maybe, or whatever, pick your instrument. That's kind of the most common thing. And taking that step, it's sort of taking a step outside your body to listen and react to the sounds around you. That is where the making music part starts. And, you know, a lot of folks that are on this journey really never get that far because they're not willing to step outside their own comfort zone. You have to be able to turn all of your own musicianship on on autopilot in order to react and respond. And that's one of the things in the band coaching we talk about all the time. What's the most important thing that's happening right now in the song? Well, if you're in a verse, it's a lead vocal. So if you're not the lead vocalist, what are you doing to make them sound better? And as soon as you can turn that into that phrase, rather than what am I going to play? No, what are you going to do to make them sound better? It's a different approach. And suddenly you're not constrained to particular notes. You are trying to feed this idea, and you're just trying to give them a nice platform to ride against. And then in turn, when it's your solo time, they should be doing that for you. And if they're not, then we have a whole different problem.
We'll be right back with you just after this. Collings Guitars has been a long-time supporter of the Bluegrass community, from collaborating with artists to sponsoring festivals big and small, and now by sponsoring Bluegrass Jamalong. Handmade in Austin, Texas, every Collings guitar and mandolin that leaves the shop is built from the sound up, and the team loves seeing a Collings in the hands of players of all levels, from local musicians to world-renowned pickers. Visit collingsguitars.com for more. This episode is also brought to you by Peghead Nation, the home of roots music instruction. With 65 streaming video courses for guitar, mandolin, banjo, fiddle, dobro, bass, and ukulele from some of the leading names in acoustic music, Peghead Nation has something for every picker. You'll learn the tunes and techniques you need to join in at jams and play the music you love, plus advanced techniques like improvisation, theory, and ear training. Your first course is just $20 per month, and you can add more for $10 a month. Sign up for any course and get your first month free with the promo code JAMALONG, all one word. Join thousands of other players, including me, who are advancing on their instruments and having more fun playing the roots music they love at pegheadnation.com. Yeah, and I that sort of hadn't occurred to me to that degree until I went to a bluegrass camp a couple of years ago, and the guitar instructor played us Tony Rice. I think he was like, "Wait as long as I can." He said, "Listen to him in the verses. He's barely doing anything, like just bass note. He's like hardly playing." And then he'll punctuate in between the vocal lines with a really strong kind of accent, and then it back right out again. And it's only when you dig in and listen to, and all of the stuff you said so far, like there's so much mileage to be gained just as a music fan by listening to that stuff and appreciating it, let alone putting it in your own thing. But that internal external point you made, I think, is fascinating, because I think one of the first things when I saw you do the session at IBMA with the band on stage is they were counting off the song. One, two, three, but sort of to each other. And you said, even before you start playing, like project that out and get some energy going. So when you hit that first beat, you land and you're off, and it involves the room in what you're doing. And even that, like before a note had been played, the amount of energy just doubled.
Absolutely. Yeah. Unfortunately, we as humans are good at sort of ramping up to where we need to be once we're going. It's very difficult to start. So I always advocate, and this is kind of a studio thing too, try to count in the energy of the tune, right? It doesn't need to be loud, but if you go a one, two, three, you know what that's going to sound like, right? That's going to come exploding out of the gate. And if it's just 1, 2, 3, there's no indication of what that's going to sound like. And what you're doing is feeding the band misinformation. Because we naturally want to go, all right, well, here we go, loping along. And it's not really helpful. And I think a lot of bands are afraid to really go after it. They're afraid, folks are individually afraid they're going to play wrong notes. We all are. I mean, nobody likes to fall on their face. The pros have just got more experience at that. They're more experienced at hitting wrong notes, letting it go, and then moving on. And I will tell you, some of the most exciting solos I've ever seen live were right after somebody fell off a tree and then recovered. And it's such a moment of joy for the entire audience to watch somebody totally ruin something and then magically come back out of it and present a really powerful ending. It actually makes the solo better. It's more memorable when somebody totally fell in the dirt And, you know, not that I advocate that, but just, I guess my pitch is for folks to be confident in enough in yourself that you're willing to play music with others. And if you pile something up, forgive yourself and let it go. In fact, this is something I've been working on for years. I was chatting with Brian Sutton about this a couple of years ago. We did some co-bill things, the Bela Bluegrass Heart and the Jerry Douglas Band and the Sam Bush Band. We did a couple weeks of shows as a package thing. And so we were hanging out literally every day, nerding over guitar stuff, which is a real treat. Anytime you get to hang with Brian, you're going to learn something about guitar and life. He's a very philosophical cat. And I was frustrated with my own playing, having whatever issue I was having. But he said to me, "Have you ever seen anybody play a wrong note on a guitar solo?" I said, "Yeah, of course." He said, "Well, how did you feel about that?" I said, "Well, it happens to everybody." He said, "All right, well, what do you do for yourself when that happens?" I said, "Well, yeah, I beat myself up." He said, "Well, you need to forgive yourself just like you'd forgive anybody else." But we're so inside our heads that it's really hard to do that. And that's that communication thing. When you take the I out of it, you become a better band member. You become a better soloist because it's a function of the entire ensemble. And truly, you can really make the band sound better than the ingredients that make up the band. I don't know if I said that clearly, but truly, truly the whole is better than the sum of the individuals. It can happen that way. And with the great bands, that's exactly what's happening. Not to take away from anybody, but the band is this living, breathing thing that is more powerful than any one individual in the group. And that's what we're all going for. There's some musical bliss in that when you feel it landing right and the groove is great and people's solos are reactive, they're interactive. It's a really magical thing. And I love that part so much. That excites me. It's one of the things I love about playing with the Sam Bush Band. If somebody plays a little riff somewhere, it's going to pop up around the stage. Everybody's listening to everybody all the time. Mm. And, you know, somebody's going to quote it or turn it upside down or flip it on its head or whatever the case may be. It's going to appear and reappear, sometimes as a joke to each other. But that's the magic of really listening and reacting and playing music together. That's the thing.
Yeah, it's funny talking about Sam Bush. There's a story I heard Billy Strings tell a couple of times about his sort of coming to terms with this understanding of kind of being fully engaged with what's going on. He said he'd been at some festival and he'd been invited up by Sam to join him on stage and, you know, kind of stepped forward and did it, took his break on this song and then wandered to the back. And there's about 15 people on stage and he thought, "Oh, nobody can hear." So I stopped for a second and picked up his beer. And he put his beer and he looked around and Sam had his eyes closed and was just locked into this groove of playing backup that probably nobody could hear because there was 15 people on stage. And Billy was like, "What am I doing? Like switching off from this moment and just thinking about me when I could." And it was such a kind of, you know, so I just looked around and Sam was just lost in the moment of how, you know, grooving as hard to this thing as he could to support what was going on. And I think a lot of people have that focus on what they're naturally, you think about what you're doing as a musician and you can get stuck in that sometimes.
Absolutely. I'm pretty sure that was the John Hartford Festival up at the Bean Blossom location. I remember that jam. And it was a rainy day and a muddy mess. And there was at least 15 people on stage. And it was kind of a disaster. That place has got a low ceiling. And our band is really kind of odd in that place because the snare drum hits. And we're very loud. We have a very loud stage. And it's hard with a low roof and a not very deep stage. Anyway, I remember a similar thing going on and you know, it's very easy to be outside of what's going on, but those true greats are 1,000% in all the time. And I've seen that time and again, spots where Jerry Douglas comes in and sits in with us on a tune at Telluride and from the second he goes, everybody's like, Yeah, we're here. I got a story for you with Jerry. We had him in on Rick Ferris's latest record, and he came in on two songs, but Too Lonely, Way Too Long was one of them. And I had charts made. Rick and I had figured out what the arrangement was going to be, and it was the first time we all sat around playing it. And Jerry came in, we got his dobro checked out, and then we went in the other room to just sit in a circle and play the song. Everybody had heard it before. I sent rough mixes or rough work tapes to everybody, so they heard the song. But we were literally going through it from the first time, and everybody was kind of slumped over in their chair. Most people had their chart on the floor, and they were kind of looking at it. And I had it laid out where people would solo, and maybe where people would do fills or whatever. And early on, there was some sort of dobro thing that was going on. And so we kind of kicked into the tune and it was fine. And as soon as it hit that spot that said dobro, Jerry reached back and wow. I mean, it was like a lightning bolt in the room, and every human in there sat straight up and just got after it. And it was because, you know, he wasn't just practicing. He was playing music. So yeah. I don't know. That's kind of another lesson I learned early on, in that a lot of us sort of run through songs and call it practice. But if you sort of halfway go through a bunch of songs, you're practicing how to do them halfway. So yeah. Really being mindful of, hey, if we're going to go to the effort to do this song, what are we going to do to make it better? And what are we doing to reinforce all the good stuff we're doing? And are we playing this at our 100% level that we want to take to stage? That's one of the things we talk about a lot in the band coaching thing.
Well, that's an interesting point. I was curious to whether there are different elements to coaching a band to play live than there are to play in the studio, because that playing out and the kind of, I think in a live environment, you can accept all sorts of mistakes if the energy is right. And in a studio environment, that's also true up to a point, because I would rather have like a cool, energetic take of a song that means something that's got a few mistakes in it than a perfect thing that doesn't. But you tend to have the perfection monkey on your shoulder a bit more in the studio than you do on stage.
Yeah, a lot of times I really have to coach people in the studio to get out of their shell. And oftentimes it's a matter of turning themselves down in the headphones, so they're forced to kind of go after it a little more. A lot of people get their mic just crazy hot in the headphones. Everybody's got their own mix and everything, which is great. But if you get yourself too hot, then your tendency is to underplay. And then the notes don't really have that sort of energy and impact. And it isn't about ripping the strings off the instrument. It's just playing decisively versus playing weakly. Yeah, so that for sure is a thing. But honestly, I don't really think of it as two different deals. And I know that sounds crazy, but at the end of the day, my job is to help people make music better together. And whether they're going to stage or whether they're in the studio, most of the same rules apply, right? Mm-hmm. We need to be listening. We need to be reacting. We need to be responsible for timing. We need to have done all of our metronome work so that we're ready to do this on our own. All of that's identical. The difference is how well you can hear yourself and how many times someone else is going to be able to listen to this performance. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the stakes are definitely higher in the studio, but I think being a good musician is kind of knowing and reacting to all of that.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And so there's a video, there's a great video actually on your website, and I'll put a link so people can go watch this, about the band coaching. And you list some of the elements that you cover when you do a session with people. And it includes showmanship, rehearsal techniques, song selection, band dynamics. And it was really that idea of rehearsal techniques I was really interested in the idea, like what are the things that people can actually practice as a band?
Sort of like five parts to this answer, but number one, everybody hates metronomes, but if your band isn't rehearsing with a metronome, you're doing it wrong. You need to get some kind of a click thing that can be amplified loud enough for everybody to hear it so that you can practice. And there's a couple reasons. Number one, it eliminates any of the arguments about who's rushing and who's dragging, because that thing isn't moving. Number two, it gets you used to playing a song at a certain tempo. You figure out where you're going to play Blue Ridge Cabin Home. It's going to be at this tempo, and you start it at that tempo every single time you practice it. When you get on stage, guess what? Your inclination is going to be to do it near that tempo, as opposed to wherever it feels like today. And sometimes it's way too fast, and sometimes it's way too slow, which has happened to us all. The metronome thing is massively important, and really you should spend at least 50% of your rehearsal time working with a metronome, especially when you're working up new tunes. But I can't overstate that, and nobody wants to hear it and nobody wants to do it. But bands that have embraced that have come back to me and said, wow, this helped so much. It just eliminates so many questions, so many variables. This thing's in time. Play with it. Obviously, you need to figure out your groove. One thing that is sometimes helpful is to put the metronome at double time. It depends on if the groove's got a shuffle in it or not, but having a double time groove puts those two goalposts a little closer together, right? It fills in the blank. And so that helps some people really get a grasp on it. You're not waiting so long for everything to happen. And the goal isn't to be able to play with the metronome. The goal is to be able to play together, but agree on timing. And I'm not into songs that don't move a little bit. I want them to push in a chorus, and I want them to pull back in a nice spot. But this is sort of the pathway. One of the other things is being able to identify things that aren't working. When you hit a spot and your band train wrecks right here, stop and back up just a little bit. The mistake I see a lot is folks will make a mistake in the third verse or with their arrangement. They've got some complicated thing. They're not going to the bridge the right way. Well, they'll stop and go back to the beginning of the song. So stop, zoom out just a little bit. Okay, we're having trouble getting into the third chord of this thing. So let's go back five chords or to the next phrase that makes sense and play from there into it and work that until it actually works. Now let's zoom out a little more, play the whole section before and the whole section that has the problem. If we can do that two or three times correctly, then we go back to the whole song and run it through. So being very careful to identify, isolate, work it out, and then expand the chunk that you're working on. That's kind of the biggest rehearsal thing. And that will save you so much time in rehearsal. I can't tell you how much time I've sat through rehearsals of people who I was just working for, and I had but a lot of hemming and hawing about where things were and what they were supposed to be doing. And it could be solved in minutes by saying, here's the problem. Here's the chunk we need to look at. How can we all come together to fix this? How can we zoom out and play those sections together and then work the tune? So the other thing is making sure, like we talked about a minute ago, that you're giving 100%. When you're playing a tune, there is nothing else. You either play it or you don't. There's no kind of playing a tune. So if you're going to kick off a tune, you're going to give it 100%. And also, you want to commit to the performance, like every performance matters, because you want to be rehearsing the way you're going to play on stage. And you don't want to sort of rehearse halfway, because then it's going to sound halfway. And you want to give your bandmates something to feed off, right? Because all of us have kind of a grumpy day every once in a while, and you don't really feel like doing this or whatever. But I assure you, somebody hits a lick somewhere and you kind of wake up and go, yeah, I love doing this. This is fun. Let's give it some more juice. So yeah, being very mindful of that and breaking your rehearsal into different chunks. So if you're going to spend an hour rehearsing with your band, it's, you know, 15 minutes on new stuff, 15 minutes on older stuff, and 15 minutes on kind of in between stuff that isn't brand new, but still isn't really dialed in, or however you want to split it, but kind of in that regard. I guess that, and selecting material with bands. Sometimes I run into bands that that don't select materials that they can sing.
Mm.
Your band has to figure out what it's good at, go after that, and then try to expand. It's a mistake to go headlong into an area that you're not really proficient with. But I don't discourage anybody from, you know, embracing this and going for it. It's a fun thing, but I think it's important for us all to take a step back and say, all right, are we good at super fast songs? Well, no, we all kind of suck playing fast solos. Hmm. Let's put our up-tempo stuff down here and maybe look for something that's more realistic. Whatever the case may be. Are we good at Stanley Brothers three-quarter time thing? Well, no. All right. Well, let's only do one of those instead of six. Mm-hmm. Just trying to be realistic about what your band's strengths are. And it's hard to self, check in on all that stuff because it becomes, with a band, you've got a lot of attitudes and ideas, and it can be a challenge to figure out if everybody's on the same page. And sometimes you're not, and sometimes that's a good thing to learn too.
Yeah, I mean, that's really interesting, that idea of, like, all the things you just said about a rehearsal, like using a metronome, splitting it into chunks, backing up and trying the passages you're not quite, like, if you were teaching somebody to play guitar, all of that, people will have heard that. Somebody would have said that to them, like, split your practice session into chunks where you're doing, you know, don't just sit and noodle through tunes. If you're playing, I don't know, if you're learning Daly's Reel and there's that tricky bit of fingering over the five chord that you struggle with, run that bit a few times. Like, don't just play the tune over and over again and hope you're eventually going to. But people don't talk about, I don't think I've ever been in a band that rehearsed in that way. I had, like, intentional, like, we'd have a two-part rehearsal. One half, we'd kind of work on stuff, and then the second half, we'd just run our set. And we did mm-hmm. it, like, week in, week out, and we didn't get any better. Like, not really.
Yeah, I guess it all depends on where everybody's goals are. This goes back to something I said much earlier today. Some folks really enjoy the hang. Some folks come away from work and go to band rehearsal, and that's their time away from work. It's a joy to play music with your friends, and it should be, and that's great. The rub is when that person's in a band with somebody who really wants to make it better and go play gigs, play more seriously, and improve the whole band. Those two aren't going to last long in the same band. And it's good to identify where you sit. I look at jam sessions kind of the same way. My folks used to have some jams back home that were amazing social gatherings, unbelievable potluck dinners, and a bunch of folks enjoying sitting around picking together. Was it a good jam? Musically, probably not. But the experience was really good. So I look at, all right, there's the social jam. There's the, I don't know, four guitar player jam somewhere, but everybody's a pretty good musician. And then there's the exceptional jam, which is like five or six people really trying to play music. And I go into it with the mindset of what it is, so my expectation is met. I struggled. I played in a band that was really, we were really good regionally, played traditional bluegrass stuff up in the Northeast and in and around Mass and upstate New York and Maine and so on and so forth for a lot of years. And we were sort of good for the region. We had an entertaining show, but some of the players in the band didn't want to take it as seriously as I did. And it took me a while to figure that out. And I was really trying to drag them into places mm-hmm. they didn't want to go. And once I figured that out, then I realized that I actually did want to pursue this professionally. And that's, it was shortly after I made the move to Nashville, doing what I'm doing now. So, I think all of that is a good conversation to have. I definitely have this conversation with any band that I'm coaching, if I'm working with them individually, because you can kind of get a feel for, you know, if there's one person that they're just not into this, well, y'all need to figure this out, because if one person's not going to put in the work that everybody else is, there's going to be a lot of animosity. There's not going to be a lot of growth. And nobody needs that. You know, we want to stay friends. We're pals. We're music buddies. But I think part of the band dynamic is making sure that everybody in the band is on the same musical page. You might have different goals in mind or different outcomes that you want, but I think everybody needs to be in a similar place in this time. Not to say it won't change, but you know what I mean? It's really tough to drag somebody along who doesn't want to be there.
Yeah, it's funny, because you were talking earlier about like how some of these lessons apply to life, and, you know, talking about the Brian Sutton thing about treating yourself the way you treat others. But it's funny how much, like, either disappointment or emotional pain comes from expecting something to be the way it isn't. Like, it's not that the thing
is necessary. That's a good way to play it. Say it.
It's like, not necessarily that the thing is wrong. It's just that what you're trying to get from it doesn't exist in that thing. And that's so true in so many areas of life and work, and just, you know, wanting something to be, however much that guy, you want that guy to be in your band, if he's not really, and he might not have the time, he might have a, you know, busy life, you might not have the emotional headspace, who knows? But I think it's really true. And as you say, those things can change over time as well. You know, I remember reading something about U2, like 15 years into them being a band, where Bono and the Edge sat the other two down and went, listen, we've been in this together for years, but U2 aren't really pulling your weight anymore. We're doing most of the organizing, songwriting, the kind of, and that's, we can do that if you want, and we'll just pay you a bit less. Or we can try and get back to, you know, and it's even 15 years into a successful band, things like that are still conversations to be had.
Yeah, and of course, that's a whole other ball of mess when you talk about the business aspect of all this, trying to run a band, even if you're just playing local market gigs or bars or whatever. There's some amount of, all right, if we're playing somewhere, we got to have something to sell. So there's either T-shirts or stickers or coffee mugs or a CD or an EP or something. And as soon as money's involved, everything can change, and oftentimes not for the better. That can really muddy the water for for what you're after as a musician. If you go into it just saying, you know, I have a full-time job, I just want to play some fun music a couple Saturdays a month. That's different than a band that wants to be playing 3 or 4 days every week, out for hire. And, you know, musically, the same thing applies. I would give everybody the same ideas that I have. But the ones that are trying to make it professionally need to take this stuff a lot more seriously. I guess that's my pitch. Or I would hope that they take it more seriously.
Yeah, it's true. And there's a point now, you talk about the band that you're in being kind of good for its area and having a good entertaining show. And so I guess it harks back a little bit to you were saying that essentially live and studio are the same bunch of things you think about. And I wonder whether this, because one of the points in you talk about in the video is showmanship, and whether there's another level that is maybe not disconnected, but just an extra thing when it comes to performance in terms of, like, physically, you know, because the bluegrass thing, you can, particularly when everybody's mic'd up, you can just stand in a line and all play. And I think it was Jerry Douglas I talked to when I did the Earl Scruggs specials earlier in the year, and he was saying about, like, physically showing the audience who's about to take a break, so, like, people can follow it round and, you know, give people something to latch onto in a visual sense as well.
Absolutely. And that's, you know, that was certainly one of the benefits in the rise of the single mic thing when that made its turn back in the 90s. Suddenly you go from a bunch of breathing carcasses on separate mics to all of a sudden there's one point for the audience to look at, and there's things coming in and out. There's a fiddle player taking a solo, and they almost got run over by the bass player who leaned in to sing a part. And there's an added element of entertainment in that. I loathe playing on single mic systems, especially as a guitar player, because I can never hear my guitar. But there is value. There is some value in it, and that's one of the draws to it. But I will say, for me, I like authenticity. And I struggle with anybody who is being not authentic when they're on stage. When I watch an Alison Krauss in Union Station, you go watch that live DVD. They're just standing there behind those mics. Mm-hmm. And it's so powerful because you see every one of them 1,000% into it. There's just no question about how intense that performance is, even though they're not gyrating around stage. It would be weird to see Chris Thiele stand in one spot for more than a minute, right?
Yeah.
But that's the authenticity thing I'm talking about. It's about figuring out who you are and trying to live within that, but make the audience part of your show in some way. If you're standing in front of a fixed mic, make sure you're not just looking down at it the whole night. Make sure you're literally looking at the audience to make them feel like they're part of your show. That's who you're playing for. Worst case scenario, look at whoever's doing whatever at that moment. If it's a verse, look at the singer. Look at the banjo player while they take their solo. If you see three heads turn that way, you're going to look that way, right? That's part of what Jerry's talking about. Mm. I remember Sam told me early on in playing with his band, he suggested, you know, kind of stepping up or making a spot. And he used to sit in with the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, and he had he would do a twin electric guitar thing with Jeff Hanna. And they were doing a show one time, and Jeff leaned over and said, "Hey, man, when we get to do this thing, I want you to follow me up and stand next to me at the front of the stage." And they went out in front of the monitors and were railing, you know, rock and roll showbiz. And Sam, he said he had a light bulb moment at, you know, just seeing that. It's like, oh yeah, the audience may not know what's happening, but now they do. And some of that has to do with the confidence of the player, making sure that you can really own it. But is that different than being in the studio? You still need the confidence. You still need to own it. You're just not physically moving. You don't get to say, you don't get to do anything physical. It's all sonic. So is it really different? I don't know.
That's really interesting, that word authentic. I think I like that a lot, because just even with that one example, you go and watch Punch Brothers and you've got like Chris Thiele, who's like an inflatable outside a car lot, just all over the place. And there's movement constantly, you know, you've got Noam Paganelli playing banjo, not moving at all. Like his face, nothing's moving apart from those fingers. And boy, are they moving. But like, he's totally intensely committed and there. And then you get Chris Eldridge, who's sort of somewhere in between. There's some movement going on and he's not totally static, and you can see. But they're all authentically doing their thing. There's not that thing of a band going, all five of us are going to do the same thing here.
Yeah, and you can tell by watching and listening that everybody is equally involved and is entertaining equally. And that's the thing that I struggle with some bands. I've worked with some bands that were trying to be more Thiele-esque, let's say, in their performance, but that wasn't their speaking personality. That wasn't how they acted in real life. You know, Chris is just, he's that way, you know, and there's other people he's just the first one that popped into my head, but, authenticity, it means a lot, because that really is a core of our music. It's acoustic instruments. It's performed by real people. Most of the time, singers and performers pickers are one and the same. We're one of the few genres that really has all that going for it. And I think the second we let go of the authenticity, it gets weird. And it may be something that sells for fans. I don't know. That's not my expertise, obviously. But I think there's something important about maintaining what the foundations of where this music came from. And I don't mean that everybody needs to play like Earl Scruggs. I just mean being true to yourself and true to the style, in the amount that you've studied it, in the amount that you're participating in it, and what you're presenting to your audience, just being your authentic self.
And there's something you said just then about bands trying to be something they're not, and that's not their personality and their speaking voice. And there's a really interesting, because obviously you are kind of a vocal coach, maybe initially, and that idea, and this may be something I feel more uniquely than the typical American might, but like 90% of British people who sing any kind of popular music sing with some form of American accent. Like, very few British people sing. Like, even when you think about, like, there's ridiculous examples like Mick Jagger, who sounds like, I'm not quite sure where he sounds like he's from, but it's definitely not London.
He sounds like he's sitting on a large pile of money.
Yes. And it doesn't sound comfortable. No. But there's like, Elton John's got this weird, but particularly singing like, and this is maybe different. Maybe Americans are more likely to sing with their own accent because that's the accent of popular music. But there's still that thing about singing with your speaking voice. And there's some singers like Dot Watson, and like recently listening to Missy Raines' new album, she sings in a very unadorned Missy Raines kind of way. And I love it. And some people have much more kind of elaborate vocal styles, but it's all got to come from you somewhere. And I wondered if there's a lot of coaching goes on around that, particularly for lead singers.
Well, sadly, in bluegrass, vocal coaching or voice lessons aren't really very prevalent. It's a hard thing to find at workshops. There are some workshops that definitely have it, but there's only a handful of us out there really teaching voice who have studied voice. There are stylist coaches, folks that know how things ought to sound and do a good job getting folks to sound like something and, you know, sort of form their own style. But from a nuts and bolts, how do you use this instrument standpoint? There's only a handful of folks in the U.S. that have the bluegrass knowledge and the voice knowledge. So unfortunately, that's something we're really trying to change a little bit, because we have a whole crop of younger people coming up that have spent so much time practicing their banjo, fiddle, mandolin, guitar, and then they get to a jam session and nobody sings. And that's unhealthy. That's unhealthy for the genre. But it all does come from speaking voice. And sometimes it's even about modifying your speaking voice so you find your natural speaking voice. Some people don't talk the way they're getting in their own way, I would say, with either jaw tension or posture or breath support or any number of things, placement, all those kind of things. Most of the classical vocal rules apply. You just have to tweak some things to get the timing right. Obviously the placement's a little brighter. But the foundation of my teaching in bluegrass vocals is classical voice. I guess really folks that are coming in who have a background in voice, learning the genre is all about listening, stealing licks from a lot of people. I recommend, if you're going to learn a song, go to YouTube or your favorite platform and listen to 5 versions of that song by different artists. And again, get your pen and paper out and write things down. What do you like? What do you not like? You can really learn a lot by listening to a version and go, yuck, that's terrible. Well, why? What's terrible about it? And it's, you know, all right, this singer is way too nasally, or I can't understand their lyrics, or any number of reasons. But try to compare and contrast, because again, you want to research through that issue. If you learn one song from one performer, you only get their perspective on it. And this is a music that was it's always been passed down by ear. So everybody knows a little bit different version of it. Mm-hmm. And so if you can pick and choose from a handful of versions of that, you've now formed your own style about how that is. You're making your own decisions about how you want to present that.
And it's interesting, like if you want to write, like as in like write fiction or write anything, people who've spent their lives reading books tend to understand what good writing is, even if they can't necessarily. If you've read a lot of novels and you try and write one, you're going to have made loads of choices without even necessarily thinking about it, about what you like, what you don't. And it makes total sense as a musician to do that as well. It's funny, you encounter people sometimes who expect to play music very well, but don't seem to listen to very much of it. And
there's an odd thing, especially in bluegrass, because it's such a participatory thing, which is great. I mean, anybody can get a guitar, a bass, a mandolin, learn three chords, and be able to play a good chunk of our repertoire, right? If you learn four, you're really doing well. But I can't tell you, there's been a couple of situations where my duo partner Ned and I would be out at a place somewhere. We would do a workshop in the afternoon and a concert that evening, and we'd have people come to our workshop and pay to get in and participate, and then not come to the concert. And it always shocked me when that happens. I mean, enough people have done this over the years that I noticed, right? Mm-hmm. And you think, all right, I have something to offer to teach you on your instrument. Wouldn't you then want to sit and see how that turns into music, you know? But it's such a participatory thing. Some people literally just want to sit around and play. They want to go to a festival just to jam. And truly, there's nothing wrong with that. They're having fun in their way, but it does give folks a disconnect. And sometimes that vocabulary, that catalog of tunes that you should just sort of know, goes whizzing by people because they spent all their time jamming with the same, you know, group of folks, and they've got this very small bubble of what's comfortable. And again, nothing wrong with that. It's perfectly fine and fun, and music's supposed to be fun. And if they're getting joy out of it, bravo. But, you know, if it is somebody that wants to get farther, or someone who's complaining about not being able to get farther, really trying to internalize more of the catalog in the ways that we were talking about is very important.
Mm. And it's interesting, isn't it, that when you do all that, you end up, it's a bit like problem solving. Like, you might encounter a problem that you've not encountered before, but if you've encountered lots of problems, you can probably find one that's similar and apply it to that. And it's like, you know, if you learn a load of songs, there might be a lick or a chord progression or something that can get you from one place to another, and you go, well, I've heard that over here. But if you've only listened to a small bunch of stuff, you just don't have that tool bag. And you know, people will take away from this conversation all sorts of things. The metronome thing might be important to people, the structure and practice. I think the one thing that I am going to take away from this more than anything is just to go and sit with my headphones and a piece of paper and follow one instrument through a track and, you know, then go back, follow another one. And with a typical bluegrass band, there's only going to be five or six instruments. So it's not like you listen to an orchestra. And you get that space as well. You tend to be able to hear them fairly distinctly, which is great.
Yeah, and I think it's important to check out different eras. I challenge you, after you do a few of these, listen to some of the Alison Krauss stuff, especially the slower things, and listen for how many bits and pieces you've never noticed before. Hmm. There's some extra stuff on some of those records. There's extra violin lines that sort of move and weave in around stuff that are just pushed way back in the mix and buried in reverb. And it's just this textural thing. But unless you're really listening for it, it's almost not there. And it's cool. It's fun. You know, what is that adding to it? Well, it's coloring the lyrics in a certain spot or whatever. It's fun for me to think about why those choices were made, not just what the choices were. And I guess that's the challenge for you as a listener. Figure out why the mandolin player is playing fills on this one instead of the next verse. Is there a correlation between when the mandolin fills happen and when the mandolin solo happens? Is it they always do this, or is it that they never do this? Some bands have a policy that mandolin never fills before the mandolin solo.
Yeah.
or, you know, whatever. But the more that you can go through your catalog of favorite bluegrass tunes, the more you can find that those kind of connections.
Yeah, I love that. There's so much we talked about that like applies just to listening to music and appreciating on a deeper level, whether you play an instrument or not. But there's also so much in there for people as an individual instrumentalist, and then that will help them play with and listen to and bounce off other people. There's like, you know, there's endless stuff to unpick just in this conversation we've had, and I've really enjoyed it. Thank you so much for taking the time to do this.
Yeah, no, this is great. I enjoy talking about this stuff, and it's a good reminder to me. Sometimes, you know, I spend a lot of time working with other folks, working with folks in the studio, and sometimes it's good for me to just sort of back up and have these conversations again to remind myself that I need to do some more listening. You know, I think if you're a serious musician, you should be listening seriously at least 15 minutes every single day, really focus listening on something, and you'd be surprised how much material you can cover. Bluegrass tunes are, you know, 2-3 minutes a piece, so it's not overwhelming. If you're doing the detailed thing like I'm talking about, the first 5 or 6 of them are going to take a while, and then suddenly you're going to notice that you're able to sort of maybe bounce between 2 instruments and get it all down in one listen, or whatever. The trick is to not get hooked by whatever the most important thing is at that moment. You know, get distracted by the banjo solo while you're listening to the guitar part, that kind of thing. But it's such a great exercise, and there's so much material that's just sitting there waiting for us to grab it.
Well, it loops back into that point you made earlier about a band, when you were in a band, to always know what the most important thing at that given moment is, and to let that be the thing that shines. But then what you're saying here is to listen to the things that aren't the most important moment will give you the skills to do that, I guess.
Yeah, I you know, you're building your vocabulary of, okay, what does the guitar do under the verse? You mentioned one of the Tony Rice cuts, and he's a great example of playing almost nothing when words are coming out of his mouth. And then he comes back in between the phrases with a big strum. Well, that affects the way the band plays in a tremendous way. It's not just going jugga 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 the whole time. The guitar part literally breathes, and that's cool. That's a cool, and it makes that sound very unique. The J.D. Crow and the New South stuff and the Bluegrass Album Band stuff, it all has that trademark thing where the guitar just feels like it keeps coming and going, and it adds this extra motion or pulse into the existing thing, which is cool. It's very cool.
Yeah, and there's just endless things to discover when you dive in. It's amazing, even with music that you feel like you've known for a long time, when you listen, there's always more. And that's the sign of good music, I guess.
For sure. And sometimes it's songs you've been singing your whole life, and you listen to the cut you learned from and went, huh, well, that's not how I do it. There was something I heard the other day that I've been singing for 30 years, and it, there's a couple notes that are not the way I sing them. I thought, huh, I know that's the version I learned it from, but somehow over the years, things kind of move, and that's cool. It's cool to make those connections. I think the key to all of this, the whole discussion today, is trying to be aware and mindful outside of yourself, trying to make connections in music, make connections in your band, and really listening and reacting, and sort of being a vehicle for the music that's coming in.
Yeah, totally. I think that's something we can all take away from this. Thank you so much. I've really enjoyed this.
Yeah, fun chat. Thanks for having me.
Great. I hope you enjoyed that. I really enjoyed that conversation. If you want to know more about Stephen's band coaching or about Dark Shadow, about anything, I've stuck some links in the show notes. Go and have a look. And there's a link to the video we mentioned where you can see Stephen talking a bit about band coaching. That is it. I will see you next time. Have a great week and happy picking. Bluegrass Jamalong is proud to be sponsored by Collings Guitars and Mandolins, making some of the finest guitars and mandolins in the world since the 1970s. Visit collingsguitars.com and find out why.